Welcome everyone to this week's Breaking History on Badlands Media, where I'm always overjoyed to be joined with Gordon, aka Ghost of Based Patrick Henry. And Gordon, how you doing today?
I'm great, Matt. I'm awesome. How are you today?
I'm okay. I'm all right. So I know last week we for those who have been following this show regularly have noticed that a continuing theme that jumps that dances in and out of almost every broadcast we do on some degree involves Operation Gladio. Because once you kind of get Gladio, everything kind of falls into place so much more coherently than if you didn't understand the importance of how the Nazis and the Nazi high command, including French, Italian, Japanese fascists that were preparing the groundwork for a fascist, transhumanist, new world order of depopulated feudalism under a banker's dictatorship. That was never resolved. Those leading figures were just simply given new assignments, rebranded, and brought into the Anglo-American CIA, MI6 industrial complex. And that's been our history. So once you get that, a lot of other things make a lot more sense and people can cut through a lot of garbage and misinformation. So that's why we talk about this a lot.
Yes, well said.
So last week we were exploring Gladio a little bit. Like usual, we dealt with some of the elements of it in around the world. And this book came up. So I made the point. Oh, I think you got a magic
thank
copy.
Thank you for sending me this. I really recommend people pick this up. I've only been able to peruse through it. I just got it a few days ago in the mail from y'all. But this is an awesome. The content in here is awesome.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing. And this is, for those who don't know, this is the empire on which the Black Sun never set, the birth of international fascism and Anglo-American foreign policy by Cynthia Chung, my wife. And it's been such an invaluable resource to just help my own research, my own discoveries. And Cynthia's really brought a lot to the table, a lot of forgotten discoveries that others have made and her own discoveries as well in the course of like 14 amazing chapters going through different elements of Gladio around the world. So today we have a special guest who will be carrying this on a little bit since she's working on volume 2 as we speak, and some of her chapters, or what will become her chapters, have been increasingly made available on her Substack, especially dealing with what wasn't tackled so much in this first volume of how the Nazis were given new jobs, specifically in Vietnam, Southeast Asia. So what the hell was the Vietnam War about? Who the hell made that terrible, bloodletting, purgative, violent decision? And of course, can't answer that question if you don't look.
And Gulf of Tonkin, it's like, I mean, which most people understand now that Gulf of Tonkin, it was like a false flag to get us into Vietnam, right? So
Yep. That's some very fascist thinking right there. And so this, the new series that she has been producing on her Substack is going to flesh out, is already fleshing out quite a bit of this material, as well as in this question of South America. What's really behind the whole weaponization of immigration? You know, we're obviously it's very, very tumultuous. There's a lot of destabilizations. Also, you know, is it really China? That's the messaging. We're all being given it. It's a subtle Chi-Com agenda to destroy American freedoms. That's really what we're being, it's being repeated so much. So I wanted to show quickly before I bring Cynthia on a short 1 minute presentation by a U.S. military general at a recent summit tied to NATO discussing the disruptive influence of Russia and China against the rules-based international order. I'm going to show two or three maps, and then we're going to bring in Cynthia to discuss some of this, as well as what's especially going on in what's really at the heart of the problems of Latin America. So first, a high-level U.S. general. I forgot his name all of a sudden.
But I'll start with what we all know to be true, is that the world is increasingly descending into chaos and disorder. And from Europe to the Middle East to the Pacific, we're seeing significant shifts in state behaviors, and they are not random. At a recent state visit to Moscow, the PRC president, I won't utter his name, was overheard telling the Russian president, "Right now there are changes the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years. and we are the ones driving those changes together. The changes referenced are a challenge to our security, our freedom, and our well-being. We're seeing a world that's increasingly moving from adhering to rules to prizing national power, from focusing on economic development to emphasizing national security, and from relying on market efficiencies to developing and building national resiliency. Recognizing this disorder, our national security strategy highlights that we are in the midst of a strategic competition to shape the future of the international order.
All right. I mean, the hypocrisy was yeah. insanely loud.
It just makes me sick, like, listening to that guy speak. I have no idea who that is, but I mean, contrast that real quick. Let me just like share on my screen of this tweet from Colonel McGregor, who I believe is retired. I'm almost sure he's retired. But this is from this morning. Nobody in Europe has an interest in going to war for Ukraine. This is a complete proxy effort. And if you just go look at his feed, we won't do that right now, but he's been given a lot of signal as to like all this, as to all this. This is like, this is all subversive. There's some clandestine operations at work. Like, we need to keep our head on a swivel and understand like the like what's actually happening here. And it just pisses me off, man. It pisses me off that you have generals out there speaking the way that guy was just speaking.
Yeah. And to say it's like that there are subversive states out to disrupt the national order by imposing their national will over the rules. And I mean, if you just compare, you look at it, just today we have U.S. destroyers that are sailing through the Taiwan Straits. It's like, we're going into China's backyard. You don't see China sending Chinese destroyers into the Cuban Straits or something like that, as if Cuba's even part of the United States, right? Or through the islands of Hawaii or something. You don't see that, but you do see this happening every month, provocative saber rattling in China's backyard, in Taiwan, which we don't even have diplomatic relations with because Taiwan is officially recognized as an autonomous province of China, still by the U.S. government itself. And if you look at it, this is the U.S. military basing operation in and around China. I mean, you know, like Guam. Why the hell are we in Guam? But this is like complete 150,000 U.S. soldiers, huge military industrial basing operations. And if you take a step back out even more and just look at, well, what is the power projection of this whole deep state onto the world in 2024? And I mean, yeah, there's a lot of bases inside the United States. That makes sense. Never mind the fact that one of them is run by a British general or second in command, Fort Cavazos in Texas, which is weird. But then this is just insane. This is like nearly 1,000 U.S. military bases. And yet China, which has literally 3 bases outside of China, is being considered the cause of all of our problems. So it's just important to have that context in mind when we're having to fight through the messaging, the misinformation. And this is what I think revved Cynthia. We were watching some Tucker Carlson interview a while ago, and Brett Weinstein was on describing his personal experiences in the Darien Gap, having been given a guided tour by an ex-Green Beret, special forces, front lines in Iraq and Afghanistan, and won't name his name. And then he gave Brett Weinstein, who became a bit of a celebrity under COVID, a tour of the Darien Gap. And Brett Weinstein was briefing Tucker about his experience and how obviously this is China behind everything and trying to subvert the United States. And Cynthia got so fired up out of the layers of wrongness in that whole thing, knowing what she knows about U.S. intelligence. So she just jumped right into this multi-series Substack production, which is becoming her new book increasingly. So this is why it's really great to have her on. Cynthia, I'd like to everyone here in Badlands Media to finally be introduced to Cynthia Chung. Welcome aboard, Cynthia.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm a big fan of your show. You guys are great. So it's a real honor.
Welcome, Cynthia. It's so great to meet you. This is the first time we've met. And thank you for the book. I really look forward to plowing through it. I did see that you had some Pico Sykes stuff in there, some Middle East stuff. So that's my wheelhouse and what I'm really honed in on. And it's amazing how all of it's connected. I mean, it's all Operation Gladio or iterations of it, like we talked about last week. So I'm really excited. And your Substack articles are great. I'm going to post the link in the comments. So I encourage everyone to go listen to them. They're very, very well done. Or listen to them, or read them, or listen to them on the app if you have the Substack reader app. But yes, so welcome.
Thanks.
So Cynthia, the two most recent pieces that you did is part one was on how Panama became the Skynet for Orwellian totalitarianism in the Americas. It's a serious piece. And then you did a follow-up, which is part two of what is essentially a three-part series. The other part two was The Enemy Within, a story of the takeover of the U.S. military and the birth of the perpetual war machine. Both of them are on your Substack. They're linking in different things that I didn't know how to think about so coherently. You've obviously really established Operation Gladio in your books and a lot of your writings. Like, what is it? We've talked about this over the course of the last months. But Operation Condor, Operation Phoenix, these were not things that they were kind of floating out there for me. And it was only with what you did that sort of began to tie this together as different parts of the same beast. Can you say a little bit more about what connects Operation Condor? Well, what is Operation Condor and how is it tied to Phoenix? And how does
I'll do a very quick historical overview for people who are probably already familiar with it to a certain extent, because you guys were already talking about it last week. But people need to know that this started primarily out of World War II with the Churchill secret armies, the stay behind units that have been justified at the time when World War II, I mean, it was already being brought up as an idea under Operation Unthinkable before World War II was over, but it was clear that the Germans were going to lose, but they didn't want to, dismantle the armies, which usually during our more sane periods in time, most nations recognize that you shouldn't be building up a military industrial complex during peacetime, but you should return to largely civilian duties. You still have a functioning military, but you're not just constantly building it up or being stationed outside of your own country. Whereas Churchill was making the excuse that we needed to continue to build these stay behind units because he was saying that Stalin was going to invade Western Europe. That never happened, and there was a huge declassification that occurred at the end of the 1990s under the Clinton administration that declassified a whole bunch of CIA, FBI, NSA files and beyond, also implicating MI6, showcasing that these stay-behind units continued up until at least the 90s, although clearly, as we're going to find out in me speaking about this further, they have continued. But it was a huge exposure that these stay-behind units, because there never was an invasion by the Soviets, began to inflict terrorist acts on the actual people within their countries, and they would blame it on communists. And this was sold as a justification, at least within the areas that knew about it, because most of the military in the United States or Britain and other countries, they weren't aware of what was going on. This was considered part of clandestine operations, which was a need-to-know basis that was really increasingly the intelligence, the British and the American intelligence that were running these things without the knowledge of their militaries. So this was justified as a way to encourage people to vote for far right wing government, because it was known, for instance, the Italian elections were the first after World War II that it was likely that the communists were going to be voted into that government, because the communists throughout World War II were the ones primarily, specifically the Stalinists, were the ones fighting the Nazis and the fascists. And so there was a huge panic that there was going to be a complete sweep throughout Europe of communist governments that were going to be democratically elected into government. And so this was considered an intolerable thing. And that was one of the first things that justified the CIA going from a desk job to increasingly going out in the field and doing clandestine operations to without the American government or the military even knowing a lot of what was going on. So then this continued. And as you guys probably talked about, Gladio went into the Middle East. Otto Skorzeny, the infamous mastermind Nazi who was a big player in the Gladio strategy, he was a primary mover in the Middle East, so training armies in the Middle East with the Mussolini tactics and so forth. And then Vietnam was the first one for the Americans, where I really view increasingly Vietnam as this big laboratory. And this was the birth of the counterinsurgency on that level. Like the French had already started counterinsurgency tactics in Algeria. And this is also what caused part of the French military and French intelligence to go to want to overthrow de Gaulle, was because de Gaulle was trying to take France out of Algeria, because this was supposed to be increasingly an age where there wasn't supposed to be any more colonial assets. And the thing people need to realize is that Gladio is increasingly becoming like a parallel state, a parallel army, a parallel police force that was going global. And they had an ideology that was very much like a crusader type ideology. That's why they have the sword. Gladio is the sword. And if you look, the first British Special Forces, their emblem is also the sword. So the Algeria tactics were the things that the Americans were very much being taught in to start, you know, expanding upon in Vietnam as their little laboratory. And people also need to realize that the Green Berets, the U.S. Special Forces, was not something that Kennedy brought in de nouveau in his administration, but actually those were what happened in World War II. They mimicked basically the British Special Forces. Mm. The whole Green Beret is a symbol, a tipping off of the hat to the British Special Forces. So it was very much an attachment of a British intelligence policy. And you know, after World War II, when the United States, I think there was a huge chunk of the United States military and government who wanted genuine peace. It was Churchill who announced the Iron Curtain, which I now increasingly also understand this as this was actually a justification to continue the clandestine operations, the paramilitary units, the parallel states that were starting to be set up. You know, in terms of a parallel state, I mean like separate police stations, separate interrogation centers, separate prisons, separate torture centers that were not supposed to be known by most people, including members of democratically elected government. So this was starting to really take over. And I'll do say a little bit more and then have you guys maybe ask a question or clarify something. So this counterinsurgency tactic under Phoenix Program, which is the most notorious, it was like over 70,000 people were tortured and killed under the Phoenix Program for absolutely no justification. They were really experimenting on forms of psychological warfare. If you look at what Colonel Fletcher Prouty talked about for the Vietnam War, there was absolutely no reason for the Americans to be there. And an important point for people to know is that the justification for the U.S. military to enter Vietnam was because there was an artificial migrant crisis that had been caused, where the CIA Saigon mission under Edward Lansdale had committed a whole bunch of terrorist attacks in northern Vietnam. And people need to realize this is a very sleepy region of the world. Vietnam, before all of this happened, where they had the same, you know, fishing communities and rice paddy, you know, farming. All of this had been unchanged for centuries, and people typically did not leave their villages. They stayed there always, like for generations. And so there was this mass upflux of people who desperately wanted to leave northern Vietnam and go to southern Vietnam. And the Americans were very much fueling this, and they even had transport ships to transport transport as many Northerners down to southern Vietnam. And a lot of them also made the dangerous journey directly by foot. And these people had been promised that they were going to be taken care of in southern Vietnam, and it ended up they were just dumped into the area. So, of course, you know, crime increased, banditry, thievery, and there is a whole situation there that I don't have enough time to talk about on the show, but I write about it. That then, with all of these CIA clandestine operations for several decades, ended up pulling the whole U.S. military into the conflict at that point. And that's one of the strategies, is that you have all of this kind of clandestine operation that happens throughout various parts of the world until it gets too large. And then, and it's always under the purview of the CIA. It's clandestine operations are not under the U.S. military's, you know, responsibility. They don't even need to be aware of what's going on. And then once it gets to a certain point, then they're like, oh, well, we have no choice now but to bring in the U.S. military.
A lot of really good points made there, Matt. I'll let you respond first.
That was great. But the destabilization, because that's one of the things that I always confused me. Like, what was it? What was it about the chaos in Vietnam that justified sending military personnel there to begin with? And so what you've just said adds a very important layer to this, that there was this artificial chaos that you just finally like elucidated where this came from. The Lansdale operatives were, so I'm just recapitulating just so I fully understand this. We're creating terrorist acts in the north to make it unlivable so that people in the north of Vietnam would then want to leave or feel like they had to leave, though they didn't want to, but they felt like they had to, promised that they would be provided for, then were dumped in the south by the United States military, or at least intelligence. And then when they were there and had nothing, then they were forced into banditry, resulting in chaos. And that became, I guess, what you're saying is the messaging or the evidence sold to the Westerners that Ho Chi Minh was trying to disrupt the life of the Southerners, and we had to go in and stop Ho Chi Minh. That's what you're saying, right?
Right. And this is what Colonel Fletcher Prouty writes about in his The Secret Team, but especially in the, it's a really long title. He made the same mistake as I did with my book, too long of a title, JFK, Vietnam, you know, the assassination of Kennedy kind of thing. But he goes through it in that book, which was published in like 1992 or so, in a lot of detail, because he ended up, you know, visiting the area and talking to a lot more people, whereas Secret Team was published in 1972, which was pretty gutsy considering, you know, that Vietnam was still going on. But yeah, so this is where the Green Berets were trained, is primary. So the Green Berets were brought in, as Prouty again explains. They were supposed to be rightfully not in active duty in any kind of way during peacetime. So Eisenhower, even though, you know, I have a lot of criticisms of Eisenhower, I think he was right in allowing the Green Beret program to atrophy because it was supposed to be peacetime. And Alan Dulles was the one who got his hands a hold of reviving the U.S. Special Forces program for this kind of clandestine operation under the service of Gladio. And, you know, for people who've maybe read David Talbot's The Devil's Chessboard, that's probably one of the most popular books. There has been sufficient evidence to show that Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under Eisenhower, were both working with the Nazis. And when World War II ended, a lot of these Nazis continued in aspects of politics, you know, finance and so forth, but also Gladio. Gladio continued, and it just became the secret armies of Churchill, which became known as the secret armies of NATO eventually. But they had brought in former Nazis overnight once World War II was won. All of these former Nazis were brought in. Like, the central command of NATO for like eastern part of Europe was a position held by a former Nazi for like 16 years straight after World War II. That's clearly not a coincidence. And so all of these operations, you know, they hit Middle East, Vietnam, and also South America. And the Green Berets are unfortunately something that has been taken over with this kind of, they're basically subservient to Gladio. Did you want to say something, Matt?
No, I just noticed that. I was looking at what Gordon had shared there as you were speaking, just to put some, what do you got there, Gordon?
I had this pulled up last week. I just never shared it, but you had mentioned him last week, Hausinger.
Yeah.
So who became, you know, the chair of the military for NATO, the first one. And he was the high command of the German army from 1938 to 1944. So, you know, there you go. And then there's this idea that he was part of Valkyrie, Operation Valkyrie, they made the Tom Cruise movie about the guys who were the good Nazis who were trying to kill Hitler, except for the fact that he was standing right next to Hitler when the bomb went off. So I highly doubt that he was behind the plot if he was standing right behind, like right beside Hitler when the bomb went off. So just wanted to, yeah.
What a patriot.
Yeah.
But it's anyway for the team. No, that's interesting.
Also saw that when like just preparing for the show, looking up the Green Berets, so they were like formed around like 1952 when U.S. Special Forces kind of started, but they didn't really become part of Special Forces until Kennedy made them so in 1961. They started wearing their Green Beret hat in 1955, and when they showed up at the first ceremony wearing their hat, all the onlookers, all like the military brass, like onlookers, thought they were NATO soldiers, thought they were foreign NATO soldiers. Like, wait, why are these guys wearing a Green Beret? Like that, they must be European. These must be like NATO guys. And then a year later, I forgot who it was. Bandit. He banned the Green Beret. He's like, you're not allowed to wear the Green Beret anymore. This is too confusing. It's like, you look like a bunch of NATO guys. And then people just kept wearing it anyway, just like serendipitously. But, yeah. Interesting, like little history that I never knew about the Green Berets, but
it was Eisenhower who banned them from
I think I have his name right here. It was Adams, I think. He was involved in like the special operations. Mm. But yeah, so he was the one who banned him in 1956. Paul D. Adams, General Paul D. Adams. He was the post commander at Fort Bragg. In North Carolina, which is now Fort Liberty. But that's where they were training them at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Didn't you have a connection to the British Special Forces that had a major role in shaping what became the Green Berets and American Special Forces, as well as American intelligence at the same time after World War II?
When Alan Dulles became the director of the CIA, you had Frank Wisner, or Matt says Wisner. I don't actually know. Is it Wisner or Wisner?
I'll just keep saying
Wisner, but, yes, so he became part of the OPC, I think it's a very, boring name. They like to do this on purpose to not draw attention, but it's Office of Policy Coordination, I believe, OPC. And that was the clandestine operations unit that Frank Wisner was in charge of within the CIA. But again, even within the CIA at the time, because it took time for Alan Dulles to have like control over so much, a lot of the CIA was not actually aware at all of what the OPC was doing. Actually, this was before I think Alan Dulles even became the director, and he was the first civilian CIA director, which also says something. So at this time, Frank Wisner was directly working with British Special Forces in World War II. So this must have been, now my timeline's getting all weird. So I guess that must have been OSS. They had already had it set up. But Frank Wisner had been in charge of overseeing American, special forces, working with the British Special Forces, and they were considered brothers in arms during World War II. Not to say that everything they were doing then was bad or anything, but the point being is that the Churchill secret army idea was not a good thing that ultimately did take over American foreign policy as well and shaped the whole clandestine operation, philosophy. And what Prouty brings up in his book the secret team is that Kennedy, when he came in to office, unfortunately, Kennedy did not have a good relationship with the U.S. Army or the intelligence. And he kind of made the mistake, in my opinion, of trying to have too much change too quickly, especially without enough of a trusting relationship with the U.S. military, which caused a lot of problems for him. Like, at the very beginning, and with Dulles at this point being very high level, you know, you had CIA agents within the U.S. military, within the U.S. government, who were under, you know, government or military titles, but they were ultimately in service to the CIA. It was this like this infiltration of an ideology that was turning over the traditions, the good traditions of the American government and the American military, and they were slowly taking over these things. So Kennedy understood this, but I think kind of similar to Trump, you know, you have a lot of these people being brought in, and if you don't know enough about them, it's all really difficult situation to have to deal with. They might be selling themselves a certain way, but there's no way to know. So Prouty was making the point that Maxwell Taylor, who was a military man who resigned during Eisenhower's administration, was brought in through the corridors of Dulles. And when the Bay of Pigs fiasco happened, and Kennedy was, you know, investigating this with the Cuban study group and all that, Maxwell Taylor was actually being promoted, unbeknownst to Kennedy, as a possible solution to reformation of the U.S. military. But in fact, the reality was, and Maxwell Taylor had already written a book about this, I forgot the name of it, it's like the something trumpet, that he was actually for counterinsurgency tactics. So when he was eventually made the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff position, which Lemnitzer was that position before, and he was the one who suggested Operation Northwood to Kennedy, which was a false flag proposition to attack American people and American military personnel and blame it on Castro so that you could have a direct invasion of Cuba. You know, this is what they were constantly trying to entrap Kennedy into. Lemnitzer's contract was not renewed by Kennedy. Lemnitzer was taken up to head NATO within a month's time for NATO's Gladio operations. And so Kennedy thought he was making a decision to return back to the traditional U.S. military ways by putting Maxwell Taylor in. But unbeknownst to him, it actually inflamed the situation greatly under counterinsurgency. And Taylor looks like he might have been even more radical than Lemnitzer. And it's the same problem, you know, with the CIA. You know, Dulles was fired, Bissell was fired, but these people were just replaced by other people who were beholden to Alan Dulles. So it's a very, very difficult situation for Kennedy to be in. Prouty makes the point that under Maxwell Taylor, this is where the whole doctrine of the U.S. military was changed for essentially a Gladio doctrine. So people who were being trained from this period on thought that they were representing the values and the traditions and the philosophies and so forth of the U.S. military, when actually they were being taught something completely different. And this is where like 40 host countries started to let these units come in. And increasingly, the U.S. military was being taught that they should be in charge of economic reform, political reform, cultural reform. And we see this kind of like with the Iraq War after 9/11, where all of a sudden you have the U.S. military in charge of like everything in terms of like reforming a country, which the military should never be in charge of that sort of thing. And you see like military dictatorships starting to sprout up in South America. This was, again, this idea that it was up to the military to have these things enforced forcefully and increasingly through parallel state mechanisms. It's like black ops, black budget type operations. And when they would go into these friendly countries, not communist countries, these are supposed to be friendly allied countries to the United States, they would train paramilitary units. So as soon as that country does not like what's happening, they're overthrown and, you know, puppet leaders are being put in place. So it's completely undemocratic. And these people are all being selected and put in place to be in service of the Gladio ideology, the Alan Dulles ideology, which was in service to the, you know, Churchill's kind of foreign policy view. It goes further than Churchill, but just to make it easy for people to understand, it was this idea that Churchill was representing, the high cabal idea, the League of Nations concept, where you have like about six, you know, control centers in the world, and then everything else is like a satrapy, a breadbasket. This ideology.
Man, it's, again, it was like so much stuff, and I still have things from the first rant you had that I want to talk about. But there are a few things there, like the idea of a jobs program. It's like the U.S. military for the past 20 years has been sold to the American people as a jobs program. It's like, hey, come here for opportunity. Come work for us. We'll train you in something that really has nothing to do with war fighting. And then once you leave the military, you'll have these great skills that you can then take to, you know, the private sector. And that's, I think that, like, that's kind of what you're getting at, is that that's what they started doing a much, much further back, and trying to cultivate this entire network, the system of systems, within the military that really has nothing to do with actual kinetic war fighting. So that's really interesting. You touch on the fact about the military trying to recreate all of these societies and how wrong that is. And I think that's a really, really good point for people like Badlands audience specifically to key in on. We're not going to go down this rabbit hole, but, you know, John's whole devolution, series that kind of started this whole company. It's really important to keep that in mind. It's like, we don't want the military to come in and solve the problems that we're facing right now in the U.S. We want the people to take responsibility and accountability and fix it ourselves. That's like the whole point of this. So just wanted to like leave it right there. And then just going back to the first few things you had said, the idea, what I really clued in on when I was reading the Panama article that you wrote, the idea of the parallel system, because we talked about this at GART back in January in California, parallel systems and how like parallel systems, like Patrick Henry used parallel systems in the American Revolution to subvert the British government, the colonial governments, and basically have something in place that was ready to take on the responsibilities of government once the revolution was over. In a similar manner, kind of like an inversion of that, you're describing the CIA doing the similar thing around the world, where they have parallel police forces, parallel everything that's operating outside of the purview of the public, outside of the purview of even the government or the military officers themselves. We see this in 2012 in Benghazi, when Eurocom CENTCOM, AFRICOM, who, those are the combatant commanders, and people recognize that term from John's devolution series. The combatant commanders, the military, had no idea the CIA were in Libya, in Benghazi, trafficking these weapons out of Gaddafi's armory and to Syria to arm ISIS. And for obvious reasons, the CIA did not want the military to know that. They didn't want them to know, hey, we're arming the guys that you're about to start fighting, or that is about to become the ostensible threat around the world. We're actually arming them, we, the CIA. And that's also, I suspect, the reason that Hillary Clinton didn't want the military going in there and rescuing them, because she didn't want them to know that the CIA was in there trafficking arms. So this is something that has been consistent, I think, since the 50s, since the 40s, since the creation of the CIA and Gladio, is that they're going to operate outside of the knowledge of the military, even though they've also infiltrated the military and are using the military against itself and against our people. They also are operating outside of the knowledge of the military. So interesting stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to respond to that, but I would just add one thing that you were also saying, based on what Gordon had also just brought up, that Prouty back in 1973 was even warning the American readers that if you don't think that all of these counterinsurgency tactics are your issue, this is already being built up in 1973. And he was describing it, Fort Bragg, as a core command center for the building up of this paramilitary.
Specifically, the pacification counterinsurgency tactics of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Different, will be used against the American people. That's what Prouty was saying in 1973. or 72. So yeah, it's, I mean, and obviously Prouty is a, he's a, an American patriot, and he's very pro US military, but he saw that there was something very nefarious that was taking over the US military. And I wanted to just add quickly on what you were talking about in terms of parallel states. By the way, Matt and myself, we were discussing this before, that like the bad guys, so to speak, are kind of like the Borg, where like they learn the guerrilla warfare, because the American Revolution also had, you know, it was guerrilla warfare tactics. Mm-hmm. And they learn these things, and then they like assimilate them, and then they just use it, you know, against
exactly.
the people. But yeah, the situation in Ukraine, people have to realize that all of the money that is going into Ukraine right now is to fund parallel states. It's to fund black ops. It's to fund black budget. It's to fund, you know, organ trafficking, child trafficking. All of the worst and drug, so like the all of human trafficking, drug trafficking, this stuff also it funds the Gladio operations, it funds the black operations. So, you know, the one of the reasons why there was so much drugs in South America was not a communist thing that all of a sudden, you know, became an issue. It was actually the military dictators, the fascists who were causing this. And all of this money was again going to fund these Gladio operations. The Nixon's war on drugs, you know, it was not an actual war on drugs. It was a war against the French over who is going to control the global, you know, heroin market. And the Americans took it over. And it was increasingly, you know, funding these black ops. Because, you know, de Gaulle was an amazing opposition to this whole Gladio network that was being built up. And that's why NATO was kicked out of France, because they were actually actively trying to kill de Gaulle. I don't know how he evaded like over 30 assassination attempts, which is incredible. But he had a chunk of the French intelligence and a chunk of the French military who were in support of him, even though there were another portion that were traitorous and did want to serve the Gladio ideology. And so I think that was one of the reasons why they had the Nixon war on drugs, was because the French were not totally playing ball during this time. They wanted to have, you know, a trustworthy way of controlling all of this. So that's what people need to realize. And also the fact that Olaf Scholz said now that there are British and French NATO soldiers in Ukraine that are pretty much like participating actively in warfare against Russia, which threatens to bring all of the Western world into a direct conflict with Russia, which is going to be thermonuclear, depending on how insane they're going to be about this. The reason why Britain and France were upset with Olaf Scholz saying this, claiming that this was somehow sensitive intelligence material that was going to give Russians the advantage, the long-range missiles that are being used in Ukraine, which is why you need British and French soldiers, the Ukrainians are not trained to use these things. So obviously, if these things are being used, it's because you have NATO forces. In other words, the Russians were very aware that this was happening. The reason why they were upset was because the Western people found out. And that is another point that Prouty actually makes specifically in the 1972 publication. Clandestine increasingly meant, because the Soviets and the Chinese knew what the Americans were doing in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And the people living in these areas knew. By the way, the British Special Forces were involved in training the Khmer Rouge. They still exist to this day. And they were involved in training the Khmer Rouge. So very, very bad things they were involved in this part of the world. So it increasingly was clandestine meant the American public should not find out about this. And the true patriotic factions of the country, including, again, aspects of the government and military. I'll just maybe quickly say, because we've mentioned Panama and I still haven't brought it up. So Panama was the nerve center for Operation Gladio in South America. So it was known as Operation Condor, and you had six countries in South America who were the nerve centers in South America for that. Chile and Argentina were the leaders. It shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. Chile is known for the Pinochet bloody regime, and Argentina is where most of the well-off Nazis went to after World War II. Panama was actually where you would have U.S. Special Forces training the death squads that would then work for Operation Condor in South America, as well as a centralized computer system called Condor Tel, stationed in Panama, but that was under the control of the U.S. Through CIA and other channels, the military was involved in this as well. And Condor Tel was used as a way to coordinate everything that was happening in terms of Operation Condor activities in South America, which means the Americans were totally not just aware of it, but arguably were the ones orchestrating the whole thing. And so, idea of like border crossings, one of the ways that they could do border crossings in certain ways for like death squads and all this was because this was already started in Europe under Gladio. They would have actually travel agencies to give you like fake passports and a fake, job credentials and all this, like very James Bond, type of stuff. And they, in South America, it was even easier to pretty much take over everything that was, deciding what was coming in and what was coming out of countries. And that's how you could have missing people as well. A lot of people were like transported out of certain countries and brought to Argentina, which was one of the most infamous interrogation torture centers. And you would never know. It would be impossible to track the person because they went through the Gladio, channels to get to these destination points. So there wouldn't be a record on the proper record. It would be the parallel state record that you wouldn't have access to. And so this centralized computer system was in Panama, and there's no reason to think that it isn't still in operation in Panama, which means for me, when we're talking about border crossings, like when Brett Weinstein was like saying like, oh yeah, like they're not even checking papers and they have this sophisticated system where they can just recognize your face. And the border patrol guard's like, how are you doing, Mr. Weinstein? He's like, he knew my name. First of all, that was probably, announced ahead of time that he was coming. But second of all, there is that level of control that we know for sure from the declassification of the Gladio and Condor papers from the late 1990s. It's like the biggest declassification act, I think, in history was like 8.6 million pages. But one of the problems was that was information overload. So, academics and took like, 6 years, 8 years to sift through the material to compile books. And unfortunately, by then, people are not paying attention, yada, yada. But there are a lot of books now that have come out talking about these things. David Talbot's book was made from the material from the declassification in the late 1990s. So there's no reason to think that these things have not been taken over. We're told that, the weirdness has stopped in South America because we had democratic governments who came in. It only means that the parallel states function so well that the takeover is so like enmeshed that you don't even notice it. And by the way, as Prouty said, there are parallel states in the United States. I think that kind of like, we kind of opened our eyes a bit to that during lockdown. Mm-hmm. there are these facilities that are already, there. But it goes much deeper than that, including, unfortunately, police stations and so forth. Prouty again mentioned in 1972 that these green berets that were returning from Vietnam were actually entering police units in the United States. They take policing very seriously as well in the
for local control issues.
You can think about and then we'll hit some ads. I know we got some ads. But you can think about I talked about this the other day with Virginia. Like, that's where I live. Virginia is a very it has only recently become polarized in politics. In 2021, when Terry McAuliffe ran as governor, that was the first time anyone had ever run for governor and supported abortion. Even Ralph Northam, who once he got in, the infamous audio clip of him saying, we'll make the baby comfortable, and then a conversation will happen as to whether we kill the baby. And he's a doctor, by the way. that didn't, like, he didn't even run on, as a pro-abortionist when he was a candidate. So that like, because of that, Virginia is very, very, we're not very radicalized. So people are not, they don't pay attention. They just are clued out of politics. Same way, like, if you have a dictator in, like, South America, he is going to generate dissidents and like opposition forces naturally among the people. But if the people believe they have a democracy, then they're going to be like, all right, well, we have a democracy. Our system's okay. Like, it's not perfect, of course, but we at least have a way to express our voice. It's much better to have a democracy if you're trying to take over a country, because then you can lull them into a false sense of security, as opposed to having a dictator where people are going to actually try to organize against the dictator. So interesting thing you bring up there.
Plato made that point that it's more efficient to dominate people by getting their consent than by having it forced upon them. So if you can convince people that freedom is slavery, and then all of a sudden they will fight to defend their slavery because it's now in their minds freedom, which gets us at this whole Orwellian
Huxley thing. Or Orwellian, like which yeah. one you want, Huxley or Orwell. Yeah, Huxley was probably right. He was probably right. Yeah,
that's the consensus generally, but there's always a little bit of a mix of the two. You can't just have one or the other. There's always, I think, in practical terms, and I think both Huxley and Orwell kind of agreed that there would be a necessity for both. And Cynthia's written and thought about this a lot and weaved this into her narrative. Is this all sounding more Orwellian, more Huxleyan? Like, what's your take on how these guys have a role to play in the shaping of this whole dystopic, weird structure?
Well, I think one fun factoid for people to be aware of Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, was that they went to Eton School, which is a notorious brainwashing school for Britain's elite boys and also an institution of buggery. I think that isn't a coincidence that the two arguably most famous dystopic novels were written by two people who went through Eton. And it says something about the kind of indoctrination you go through in Britain's system. And George Orwell, a lot of the insight that he had for 1984, unfortunately, was due to his experience as a chief policeman in Burma, in service to the British Empire, where he was engaged in torture interrogation techniques in Burma. And a lot of what he wrote for, like, the character O'Brien, who's the torturer in 1984, and Winston, who's the tortured, he shared, you know, viewpoints on both of those sides, because I think Orwell was not happy with what he had fallen into, but was also having a very hard time, I think, getting out of that situation. Once he left Burma, I think he was always attached to British intelligence, but it wasn't that he was like wanting to necessarily do everything for them, but it was a very difficult thing for him to get out of. So that kind of darkness is what he shows in 1984. And Aldous Huxley was also brainwashed in very brutal ways. His middle brother, Julian, is the oldest. He's the one, you know, for UNESCO, was the one who coined transhumanism. Their middle brother actually committed suicide on the grounds, but their grounds were, like, massive. They only found the body like 2 weeks later. He had hung himself on a tree. So, you know, and I know that Aldous has even said that he was happy that he lost his eyesight, because he wasn't going to get the same amount of pressure as Julian was for upholding certain things. He was happy. He kind of figured it was a little bit of a vacation that he got to talk about spiritual things, and Julian had to do the kind of stuff that he was doing. Also, Julian was receiving electroshock therapy during the London bombings, and he had a lot of issues as well, and they were actually using electroshock therapy on him. So it just goes to show that, you know, Aldous was thinking, I think, he believed in this, that the Brave New World was going to be a way to do this with the least amount of pain. As he said, Soma is Christianity without tears. But we have to realize that these people actually went through pretty brutalized upbringings, and they're not normal in that sense. And a lot of these people were really, the good was kind of beaten out of them for years of them growing up. So I don't really view it as a different, but they're just different tactics. And we see both of them being implemented at the same time by the same beast. So I don't think of it as any different. It's just, you know, you ultimately want to have a status quo. For the status quo, you need the Brave New World. But at the beginning, there will always probably be Orwellian tactics that will be used against the people.
Right.
Yeah, very, very well said. And I meant to say this during the ad break, but everyone, please hit the thumbs up if you're enjoying this. Let's get this the number one rated show with Cynthia on today. I know a lot of people right now are watching the Fannie Willis hearing, which is being live broadcast on Badlands right now. So they'll probably come do the rewatch later. But yeah, please hit the thumbs up. And that, those are some really good points. And it's, I think people today really have a renewed, or a new understanding of what you just described with, all these disclosures coming out about Hollywood and guys like Jeffrey Epstein and Harvey Weinstein and, you know, the way that, that people are mistreated in Hollywood and really suffer similar kind of experiences, not just in Hollywood, but also like MK Ultra kind of stuff where, you know, like the Ted Kaczynski's of the world, like that kind of stuff. So, I think people really do have a new understanding and their minds are primed to understand it more, where these are complex characters, like you just described, people who aren't necessarily acting on their own volition, but are also, you know, they're captives of their own life, to a certain extent. And it's because really, really nefarious people have power over them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's part of the, like, our society has this, I think, overly simplistic idea of what makes evil, what makes good, based on, you know, the Lex Luthor, Superman archetypes, which is really lame and devoid of any nuance. Whereas, like, when we look at, or this idea, you know, that I've actually been told this by people who consider themselves, you know, academics and experts in the field of psychology, that a certain proportion of the population is born with no morality genetically. They're like 1 out of 20 people is born a psychopath. Just, and they've got these weird, it's like, when did you ever prove that that was true? Like, mm-hmm. Nobody ever produced the study to prove that there's a genetic cause of psychopathy. I don't know if that's how to pronounce it. Which is like the whole point of the human genome experiment was to like find the gene that would like explain why there's gayness, why there's evil, why there's good. And it's like none of that worked. We sequenced the gene and then nothing really changed. So, but they say that, and there's a total inability to appreciate that there is a cultural field that I think plays a much bigger role than people realize in bringing about the better or the worse side, or the side of us that's tied to our conscience or not. But a lot of the worst elements, the most destructive figures throughout history, when you actually look at their bios a little bit, like Cynthia just illuminated a little bit of the crazy experiences of a younger Orwell working for the British Empire, managing torture chambers in Burma. I mean, or, you know, Huxley, the whole Huxley clan, right? They're born into a destiny almost. And a lot of them will commit suicide, like the Huxley brother that nobody wants to talk about. it broke him. Other ones are just like, they need electroshock therapy or heavy doses of drugs. Like Aldous was always on drugs. He was always on drugs for his own therapy, just to like cope with life. But they're both carrying on the abuse that was put on them, but they're also hating the abuse at the same time. They're not in harmony with themselves. They're not happy people in their castles, you know, that we should envy because they have so much wealth and power and they must be happy because look at their power and wealth. It's like, no, these are like broken creatures.
The biographer for Aldous Huxley called Huxley in Hollywood, he said that Aldous refused to send his son to Eton.
Mm. Right.
It's that bad.
Interesting.
And they were living in the States then, so it didn't really matter, you know, for American pedigree. They didn't really care about that sort of thing, whereas in Britain, you know, it really meant a lot.
Is that Eton College? I saw you mention that in your article. You said you went to school at Eton. Is that Eton College in Berkshire, like in England? Like, is that the school you're referring to? Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so everyone listening who hasn't read the article, both Huxley and Orwell went to the school and they were there at the same time. Is that how I understand it?
They were definitely, Julian, Aldous, and Orwell were overlapping with each other. Yeah.
Okay.
They definitely were all there at one point at the same time. Yeah.
Very interesting. Did not know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's the other thing that people need to realize too, is that Operation Condor was bringing up, thought police type tactics. I think they probably were being brought up in Europe and Vietnam as well, but it was like the most extreme form I find in South America, where you could be just arrested for potentially being subversive. And we're seeing that now increasingly being brought into the United States, into Canada. Apparently, Matt, right, there was a bill, was it passed yet or not? But they're like at least proposing a bill where you can be, charged, possibly go to prison for hate crime or some kind of dissonance, but that we don't even need evidence now, apparently, for this. It can be just someone saying that they feel a certain way about you or whatever. So part of like the whole phrenology thing, which back then it was like, if you felt the bumps on someone's head and you could either see if they were a criminal, if they were going to be like a rapist or whatever.
Nazi ideology, by the way, ideology
in the court system. Mm-hmm. And then the Human Genome Project as well, to try to find the criminals that are born this way. I see this as totally connected with this idea of Orwellian thought police, which is that they want you to believe in these things, and obviously that you're not going to be affected by this. This is for the other people, but it's a way to put people in prisons for no good reason. They're always looking for ways where they can justify how you can put someone in prison. Right now, the best they've got is like a thought police sort of thing, which is kind of on shaky ground. But if you can find even a convincing artificial biological reason, you could see how so many people will be sent to prison, not because of anything biological in reality, but because of something political.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting. I want to touch on something about psychology now that we're on the subject. But before, I just want to mention that before you had mentioned with Condor, with Argentina being a big hub for it, also worth pointing out, you mentioned these Gladio lines that got them from Europe to South America, the rat lines that a lot of the Nazis used to escape after World War II. And most of them went to Argentina, like Uruguay. So, again, another big Nazi hub. And this is where Condor is operating out of. I was thinking about that a lot when I was reading your articles. But the psychology thing is interesting because you had mentioned before, which I'm glad you said it because I've talked about this as well, but creating a kind of like this specter of communism, like building up this idea, like communism is kind of a meme, like they never actually really even come close to trying to deliver. And of course, the communists in earnest are saying we've never tried real communism. We've never had real communism. And that's because it's not really about communism. It's about totalitarian dictatorships and totalitarianism. But there's a guy at Badlands, Chris Paul, who is a lifelong liberal who only like woke up a few years ago, 4 years ago or so. And but even when he was a liberal, like a progressive atheist liberal, he said that, he was against communism because he understood like what it was. But he has a funny thing where he now and I've kind of adopted it myself, where he calls Rhino Republicans communists, partially because it triggers them because they're conditioned to think that's like something bad and evil. But it's also kind of like he inverts the idea of like fascism versus communism and how they're diametrically opposed and they're the complete opposite. And if you oppose communism, you must be a fascist. If you oppose fascism, you must be a communist. But really, it's like they're two roads that lead to the same place. And so I think the psychology of post-World War II building up this fear of communism that then drives voters, citizens, into the arms of fascists who ultimately are going to do the exact same thing that they are fear-mongering the communists are going to do should they take over. That whole dynamic is a relatively recent epiphany for me, and it's just fascinating to like realize that, because once you understand that, then the whole idea of NATO being the Third Reich or the continuation of the Third Reich, the Nazis being like having actually really won World War II to a certain extent, that really begins to make sense. You really begin to understand like the funding of both sides. Why would you fund, you know, both sides in a war like that? And how could they all be connected? But anyway.
I have something quick, Matt, before you jump in, because I can see you want to jump in. But yeah, the way that I'm increasingly seeing this from a historical point of view, because that's always, I always, you know, do the historical research in order to understand the present time that we're in. But it's again, like so much of the tactics that are being used, including like the black ops, you know, private armies type stuff. This was all British Empire, British East India Trade Company, strategies that were being used. And Milner, which Matt has done a lot of work on, apparently, Matt, right, someone has brought to your attention that Milner was even pro-communist. He was speaking good words about communism at the time. And, you know, Engels...
1882, yeah.
Yeah, and Engels was also like, you know, at the end of the day, he was actually a British imperialist. A lot of the things that were told in terms of like, you know, the fascists, the communists or whatever, at the end of the day, it really is a British imperial ideology. The League of Nations, even Kalergi, who's talking about the League of Nations was revived under pan-Europeanism under Kalergi, which then became, you know, the European Union. But originally it was supposed to be under Kalergi, the Apollo Sun with the Crusade cross. And then later on the stars, and then the European Union just took out the Apollo Sun and the Crusades cross. But it's like it's implied if you know Kalergi. Kalergi was even saying that under the League of Nations mandate, Britain would be the only one not held accountable in the same way as even the world controllers would. Britain is a special case because they have their hand in every region of the land. And so they're above it all. And so I think that that is a reality. The fact that Churchill's foreign policy was what totally dictated the whole clandestine operation situation in the United States is what's there. And so the communism from what I'm increasingly seeing it as with social imperialism under the Cecil Rhodes Milner school. And then you have the National Socialism, which was not ever national under, you know, Hitler and Mussolini, was clearly imperialistic. These are all like from the same school. And then you had, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was, I increasingly look at it as a British thing that they wanted to have take place, and that Trotsky was their man. Like James Burnham is a connection to Trotsky, the neoconservatives, the sort of the spiritual father of neoconservatism. James Burnham was, you know, a chief assistant to Trotsky. Yeah. Then he says, oh, you know, 6 months before Trotsky's killed, which I don't think is a coincidence, he says, oh, no, I'm not for Trotsky anymore. I'm for Bertrand Russell and Dewey. And the likes of these people, this is my new religion. He works for the OSS, he works for the CIA. He was very much around the whole Truman Doctrine, which was the first, you know, justification for America to go into a country the way that they did, which is in Greece. You had the Stalinists who fought back the Mussolini fascists, and then the Nazis came in, and these forces were fought back the Nazis. And then you had actually British Gladio units that started to fight these Greek Stalinists. And it got so bad that even the British are like, okay, because they wanted to put back a pro-Nazi monarch in Greece. So then the Americans came in and they dropped napalm on the Greek people. And then Greece was at that point hollowed out, and it became one of the first countries to be brought into the taken over United Nations. That was never Roosevelt's vision. It was a taken over. And they were then a launching pad for Gladio into the Middle East.
Yes. And that is something I mentioned at the end of the show last week. That's something that I'm really starting to dig in on now, like Greece, Turkey, like that whole region and the role they played as the launch pad into the Middle East in for Gladio. It's really, really fascinating. And how that all connects to Russia and how that connects to everything else. Interesting point you make with Trotsky. Orwell, who we were just talking about, publishes Animal Farm, which is effectively about that whole revolution, the Russian Revolution, Communist Revolution, Bolshevik Revolution, publishes it 2 weeks before the end of World War II. So he publishes it in the middle of August, 1945, and then it's like September 6th or whatever is the official end of World War II. So 2 or 3 weeks before the war ends, he publishes Animal Farm, which is like a work of fiction meant to really communicate to the American people how evil communism is. And it's like, that's where you get the fear mongering, like the fear mongering machine.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a weird time to publish something like that, right? Mm-hmm. When Russia had just like fought 95% of the Wehrmacht and saved the world. That document? That's true. Good point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And what Cynthia said, what you brought up about Burnham, I was thinking as Gordon was talking earlier, by taking little jabs, the rhinos, the neocons, of the Republican Party as being communist, it's provocative, but it's really true, because Burnham is known to be the founding father of the neoconservative movement. That's Burnham. Burnham was the personal assistant to Trotsky. I mean, it's so true. It's so much more true than it's true, but then you just think about what you just said there about Burnham and the whole Trotskyist that became the neocons, right? They were all Albert Wolfstetter, who you've written about, the Irving Kristol, they were all Trotskyists who became the vanguard pioneers of this new weird synthetic cult that took over the Republican Party throughout the Cold War. They're all Trotskyists.
The fact that Wolfstetter was like leading RAND policy, and him and Herman Kahn were notorious for saying like, hey, yeah, we should have a nuclear war, which, by the way, we're again in this kind of position. We should have a nuclear war, even if that means that America will be hit by nuclear weapons, because it's worth it.
It really is amazing how like similarly aligned in thinking y'all are with Chris Paul, and like y'all come at it from the history angle. He comes at it from the philosophy is his background. And you both arrive at the British Empire. You know, he calls it the British Prussian Empire system. Like, and when I saw this book cover, I was like, man, did Chris Paul make this for you? Like, did he make this graphic for you? Because it's so just all the Badlanders listening right now who are fans of his, I think will appreciate that all these different people that I know, y'all, Chris, Warhamster, and I know Warhamster has some background with y'all as well. So he comes at it from a similar angle, but it's like all these people independently are researching this and come to the same conclusion. Yeah. They're like, yep, this is the British Empire, continuation of that. And it, you know, certainly goes back further than that probably, but, that's really like how we can think of it in this modern era, the past, you know, 500 years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you know, anybody who loves truth, you know, it doesn't take, if you really love truth more than our own axioms, you know, we all have assumptions. Some assumptions are better than others. Some of them are holding us back from making discoveries. But as long as we love truth more than our assumptions and are willing to put our fundamental assumptions into examination, which I think everybody who loves truth should do, then you will naturally discover the truth. And there is this oligarchical agency that was called the British Empire as the seat of command for like the world government before, you know, even before there was communism, there was this globally extended one world British Empire utilizing intelligence, banking, synthetic cults, divide to conquer, you know, animated by the need for depopulation. That was the world that was shaped by that type of thing. And it didn't go away. It didn't self-dismantle. It never does. And we will discover from whatever angle we're coming at it, that that's a thing. It's still the thing today. And it's interesting how we all have different personal experiences based on our own individualism and subjectivity as we've made the journey, but it's fun to cross pollinate and just share, yeah, our experiences of how we came to the same ultimate type of discovery at the end of the day. So yeah, I had never spoken to Chris Paul. I'd like to chat with him a little bit about some of this stuff.
Oh yeah, that would be a fascinating conversation for sure. Maybe one day we'll have to get Chris on here to talk about it, because he has actually gotten into history lately. He's been going deep down into history holes because he realizes how far back all this goes. So
nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sweet. Well, I'm super happy that Cynthia finally got a chance to speak to the Badlands audience and yourself especially. And so I don't know if there's any questions coming in from people, or should we just sort of phase it out?
It looks like we have a rant. I think we have some. We have at least one rant, and then I'll go check the Badlands boost. Cynthia, if you wanted to, why don't you do some closing thoughts and maybe talk a little bit about the Panama thing? Was really fascinating, like the Panama Canal, the Suez Canal. If you just want to do like a few minutes on that and how that all developed. I actually didn't even really realize that Panama wasn't its own country. It was part of Colombia until we went in there at the turn of the 20th century and basically made it its own country. I thought that was really fascinating. You do that and I'll grab these boosts.
Sure. Yeah. So, the person who made Panama Canal was actually a French engineer who is the same person who made the Suez Canal. So I think that that's an important point for people to realize. Obviously these are good things, but at the same time, they were made as control points for something that ultimately has caused a lot of conflict. But Teddy Roosevelt, once this was starting to come under construction, basically wanted to take that part of the land, which at the time was Colombia, under Panama, to create an independent nation. So he sent at least one battleship there and basically, you know, attacked people who were clearly in no way capable of defending themselves against such a thing. And Panama was declared an independent country, but with military bases established. And there was at least four military bases that were started pretty soon after all of this by like about 1912, but they were built up to over 20. There was a wave of some of them being closed off in the 1950s, but there were a lot that were closed by the late 1990s, but there are still U.S. military bases, like especially Navy and communication centers, Condortel, that are still in operation today in Panama when it's supposed to be an independent country. And I want to say maybe something real quick, too, about the Chinese being there. The reason why the Chinese, when they're working on these development projects, you know, highways, the nefarious highways and bridges, which, by the way, John Perkins makes a point in his Confessions of an Economic Hitman that Central and South America were attacked financially by, you know, the World Bank, the IMF and so forth. And they were gutted and they were enslaved financially and not just with these terror tactics. By China coming into these countries and wanting to work on infrastructure, and at the behest of the government inviting them in to do this, this has always been understood as an economic booster. An economic booster is a booster to national sovereignty. And so for those who don't want national sovereignty in the world, clearly this is a threat. And there have been many construction camps, you know, for building these development projects that China is heading, that they've been attacked by terrorists, by saboteurs. So that's one reason why there's a certain amount of you're not going to just allow anybody to come into these places and take pictures and this sort of thing, because it's easier to have sabotage. But, you know, Panama has every right to want to accept help to build up infrastructure and so forth. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the correlation, just I don't know as much about the Panama Canal as I do about the Suez, just because I've been reading into the Middle East more. But the time, like when you lay out some of the timing in your article, it just makes me realize that, you know, that was happening really on the heels of the Suez Canal and what the British were doing to the Egyptians. And, you know, just 5 or 6 years after the Suez Canal being finished, the stakeholders in Egypt, you know, went bankrupt. And so then the British stakeholders come in and buy up their shares. So then now Britain fully owns it. And then 10 years later, they come and invade Egypt in the Anglo-Egyptian war. And then they control it like kinetically. So they control it with the military. They own it financially. And then that kind of sets up a lot of things that happened leading up to World War One. But it is crazy how these things have unfolded. And a lot of, like, what I say often is recently I've been saying is that to view our system that we have right now, like what that general was saying, that people are no longer following the rules. And, you know, he's trying to make it sound like they're like immoral, like they're not following these really, really moral rules that we have set. It's like, no. What we have right now is we have a vassal system where every country in the world is a vassal to the State Department, and they either do what the State Department wants and they receive foreign aid, which is then used as money laundering to pay people off and set up these proxy groups that you were describing. Or if they don't, then they get sanctioned and then they eventually get invaded by the U.S. military. And the CIA is always on the ground everywhere, as you already explained. So that versus the idea of bilateral agreements that are mutually beneficial, which we see a lot of, like what China, Russia, Saudi Arabia are starting to do, where they actually want to come in and invest in a country and have a mutually beneficial system where they aren't saying we're going to come in and own your country. They're saying we're going to invest and we're going to make money. You're going to make money. We're all going to prosper. And the rising tide lifts all ships. I think there's a lot to be said about that. And these enormous trade cooperatives, like these trade organizations, are actually just, oligarchies. That's really all they are. They're not, because if you allowed countries just to act in their own best interest and to negotiate bilaterally with one another one-on-one, I think everyone would end up in a much better situation. And to that point, I also want to point out, and there's some confusion in the chat. Some people were asking, are we arguing that communism isn't bad? That's not what we're arguing. We're saying that the binary that's been presented to us in the 20th century is fake. It's a fake binary where they're basically saying, in order to beat the communists, you have to side with corporate America. You should celebrate when these massive, multinational corporations merge together and buy each other out. Like, that's a big celebration. That's a win for capitalism. It's like, no, that's the consolidation of power. I mean, so we don't want that. We don't want that. But looks like we have a rant. So let's hit this one rant real quick before we get out of here. And then I'll just open it up for any last thoughts. This is from $20 IIS2C. Love this show. Been following Matt and Cynthia for a while now. So glad Matt has joined the Badlands lineup. The combination of him with Gordon is mind-bending. Well, thank you. And we have really enjoyed having Cynthia on today. I tagged Patrick Gunnels, who does a show reading Epic Lit on Saturday nights on Badlands, where he reads fiction or Substack articles. And he's been reading, I think he just finished doing 1984. So I sent him the article from Cynthia, and he responded back and said, oh, I'm already a huge fan of Cynthia Chung. So. So great to have Cynthia here. Any final thoughts from either one of you?
I actually wanted to just say really quick about Teddy Roosevelt. He was actually an Anglophile, American president. He put British foreign policy very clearly as his, purview. And also, he was the one who set up the FBI largely. He was responsible for this, which I also view the FBI as something that's never been a friend to American freedom and liberty. And, there was a Bonaparte family member as well that was involved at the very beginning of this whole launching of what was the FBI. Again, as we to fight back the Red Scare, but it was always a terrorist apparatus against the American people. And it clearly showed its face under the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was Charles Bonaparte. He was somehow the Attorney General of the United States under Teddy Roosevelt. Was Charles Bonaparte like the nephew of Napoleon?
That's
who sets up the FBI? It's the weirdest friggin' Freemasonic thing. Yeah, and in fact, exactly. We were always told like what happened in the Cold War was some like novel thing that had never happened before. No, it had happened before and during and after World War I. And it was that controlled dialectic of just destroy all of the reasonable, like real city builders in America, the McKinleys, the Lincoln Americans, who are like trying to work internationally to help other nations break free of empire and feudalism and become sovereign, self-sustaining, industrial like nation states by working together, building rail, using national banking protectionism to emit credit for the building of like 20-year projects that are going to uplift people and then break you, liberate them from the controls of the city of London, of debt slavery, all of this stuff. That was the whole movement of the world. And that all had to come undone. with these fake occult, you know, directed intelligence agency directed revolutionary chaos operations in Russia. Same thing was going on with anarchist operations all over the United States, killing McKinley and Garfield earlier, and, you know, killing German leaders who were like around the Bismarck circle, who were trying to bring in the American system of political economy into Germany. Same thing in China. I mean, there luckily we had a Sun Yat-sen who was able to hold things together a little bit, but even that was short-lived in a sense. But I mean, you had this whole thing, and they created this whole dialectic, as you just pointed out, with the FBI, the secret police force operations that just use the idea of national security to crush all freedom-loving anti-imperial voices, even in World War One. And it's wild. It's the same formula.
Let me take that a little further, because this is interesting, I think. So like in the 1910s, they flood the marketplace in America with booze. Everyone develops alcoholism, right? And then what do? Prohibition. So then they say, all right, we're going to outlaw it. And people buy into it because they're sick and tired of seeing all these drunks everywhere that, you know, it's destroying people's lives. So like, yes, prohibition. And then what happens in prohibition? You have gangsters come in and they make tons of money doing this stuff in black markets. And the gangsters are recruiting from the World War One veterans who have no economic opportunity because of the terrible economic conditions in America. So they then are then becoming gangsters. You have this huge organized crime that develops as a result of that. And then, oh, how are we going to fix this? Well, we're going to create this thing, the FBI. They're going to come in, and the G-men are going to come save us from organized crime, from the Al Capones of the world. Right. That whole thing is Hegelian dialectic right there, where they create the problem, present the solution, create the problem, present the solution, and you end up with the FBI.
Well said. Well said. Yeah. Dick Tracy wasn't a patriot.
Well, it's like
awesome. Awesome. A lot of fun. Cynthia, we're gonna have to have you back again, because there's a lot more to discuss with Gladio and Condor. And I think as like this migrant crisis situation gets even worse, as I imagine it will in the upcoming year, there's just gonna be more to talk about with Condor. And this is, I'm relatively new to Condor, so I definitely would like to have you on to talk about it more.
Me too. Yeah, absolutely. This is really fun. And to keep just for the audience's mind, I mean, there's so many like takeaways that have immediate application in terms of like understanding the current game and how it's being played, so that we don't fall for certain traps that are being set for us. But I mean, that's the same thing too. The amount, I could see it very clearly, the amount of rhetoric to promote or set the stage for an invasion of Mexico is real. Like that, they're expanding military bases in Texas. A lot of good people are getting sucked into this. They don't fully know all of the dynamics of what's at play, but they're being given this messaging about what's behind the drug problems, the fentanyl, the immigration crisis. And the only solution they're being told is we have to go in heavy-handed and militarily invade, with military bases that are increasingly finding themselves under the control of British UK generals that are part of the British Special Forces with experience.
I did not know that. That's amazing.
Yeah, Major General Ben Catamaral, he was just brought in a few months ago to head Fort Hood. And that it's completely the same sort of operation that was done in Vietnam, right? You just create an immigration crisis, you create the crisis, and then you solve it militarily with a solution. They're doing the same kind of thing, remix. They've done it all over the place. But what you've just done, Cynthia, in your essay series and in your books and in this briefing, very, very important thing for people to internalize how these types of things are being played. Because, yeah, we don't want that. That would be bad. That would be a really terrible solution to the problem, is falling into another British trap. And there's multiple traps. There's the Civil War scenario. That's one option. The other option is just a full breakaway, but a breakaway in such a manner that the many of the red states that don't know better end up getting entrapped.
The balkanization, this,
and then go into an invasion policy like was attempted in the 1850s under the Knights of the Golden Circle operation in the 1850s, 60s to create a slave power with Cuba as the central command of this new empire that would be an expansive thing under British control, directing the Confederacy. That's a scenario that the British high grand strategists have been holding on to. They didn't let go of that when Lincoln kept the Union together. They kept it on the back burner. So that's a factor to keep in people's minds, and just knowing all of this history,
and also
so valuable. Yeah.
Quickly to add that HSBC also plays a huge role in the drug trafficking in Mexico.
Right. And
HSBC is called Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, but it's a City of London bank.
Federal Reserve Bank. It's a Federal Reserve Bank, guys.
Yeah. It was taken over. I mean, it was made to service the British Empire during the Opium Wars. They stationed it in China, but China was considered a colony in Hong Kong and Shanghai of the British Empire. And HSBC has played a massive, massive role in the drug trafficking in Mexico.
Yeah.
That makes me think, Matt, that's a really interesting point that you bring up about the invasion of Mexico. And that makes me think about Trump's solution, where he had the Mexican military line the border, basically, and defend the border from the Mexican side. Because that's a great way to subvert the need for a U.S. invasion, is if the Mexican military is protecting the U.S. border. So, man.
Yeah, exactly. And on that point, too, Trump and Obrador, AMLO, as some call him, had a very important special relationship. AMLO is dealing with a similar type of very heavy deep state problem inside of Mexico. He's trying to stay alive and still be a patriot and keep shit together. So that's very difficult. But Trump and him saw eye to eye on some important points that many people have forgotten about. What you just said is so important. His idea was to have the Mexican side work to police their own side of the fence, but at the same time work on economic development. They had a $50 billion infrastructure investment deal that got sabotaged by Trump's State Department, but that was going ahead quite fast. That would have involved creating a new electrification grid, high-speed rail in the south of Mexico tied to El Salvador and a bunch of the adjacent countries that are very poor, kept poor largely because of the IMF and vulture funds from Wall Street that have destroyed them for decades. But that was all going to be dealt with by building real infrastructure, kind of like what China's doing right now, that would create economies where people wouldn't need to leave their homeland to come to just survive and send remittances down to their families. But that was being done. That's what AMLO still is trying to do. He's building the Mayan Railway, high-speed railway going on right now. He's got the help in a certain way of some of the Eurasian powers, but he's got to be careful because there are regime change operations. And the other thing, too, is that Trump took on the World Trade Organization by overthrowing the structures of NAFTA and by doing so in such a way that it granted Mexico, Canada, the USA, the right to use protectionism, the right to break these free trade deals by focusing on national interests over some weird rules-based idea of what economics is. And he made a lot of enemies with Chrystia Freeland, with a lot of the technocrats in Brussels, by doing what he did. But that's the thing, that if you can give nations the right to be nations, meaning represent the people who are the governments of those nations, and use protectionism, national banking, build infrastructure, work on win-win cooperation, then the empire loses their power every time. And Trump was the closest thing to anything that was moving in that direction that I've seen since JFK was murdered. And so people need to really think seriously about doing everything they can to keep this guy safe as humanly possible, going into the next few months, because it's going to be a wild ride.
Yeah, well, I look for that was all very well said, and I look forward to Cynthia's writings on the Green Berets, because I think that this is actually all going to tie into a lot of like what John Harold writes about with his Devolution series, because Trump has given a lot of attention to this JFK, the JFK military school. The name escapes me at the moment, but the Special Operations Warfare Center or whatever. Where he basically like reformed all the entire special operations. He reformed it all. He basically made it like their own branch of the military, where they report directly to the Secretary of Defense. So I think the restructuring of the special operations forces might tie in to what you were describing with the problems with the Green Berets from their onset. So we'll have to track all that. But man, this has been a great episode.
Yeah, this is fun. So if anybody out there wants to pick up, don't forget to pick up Cynthia's book, Empire in Which the Black Sun Never Set, and enjoy the ride. Yeah, we are. And we're looking forward to.
So links for her articles. I put the links for her articles in the comments. So look in the comments. Those are the two articles we were talking about. Please read them. They're very, very well done. So thank you for coming, Cynthia. And we look forward to having you again.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.